Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was published in the Journal Enquirer on March 5th. It's written by Eric Bedner, and it's titled, Veterans Home at Former Phelps Mansion in Vernon Gets $642,000 Grant for Improvements. The Phelps Village in Vernon, Connecticut, home to 21 formerly homeless veterans, is receiving a $640,000 federal grant for extensive renovations, the first significant improvements to the property in more than a decade. Sharon Castelli, the CEO of Chrysalis Center, the owner of several veterans' homes throughout the state, said the funding will make improvements to the property, which hasn't been significantly upgraded since the former mansion was converted to veteran housing in 2013. The grant will cover the cost of repairing masonry on the mansion, rotting trim and windows, new steps and railings, lighting, heating and air conditioning systems, and the deteriorating brick wall that runs along Prospect Street. Renovations will be done to the main mansion as well as the other two residential structures on the property. All of the improvements aim to maintain the historic nature of the 122-year-old mansion formerly owned by Connecticut's first Attorney General, Charles Phelps, who built the home as a wedding present for his daughter. It is our primary goal to make sure that it's safe and accessible and that it matches the integrity of the historic nature, according to Castelli. It's safe right now, but we're going to have to give them a better place to live because they deserve it. Castelli said that the ages of the homes current residents vary, with some serving in the Korean War, Vietnam War, and Operation Desert Storm. Some came back with post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse, leading to them becoming homeless. They are now working and living peacefully as they get back on their feet. We're here to help them get their lives back together. Nothing is more important than caring for our veterans who served and sacrificed for us, Senator Richard Blumenthal said about the funding. For many years now, we have neglected housing and care of veterans, and now we're playing catch-up. Whether it's housing for formerly homeless veterans in Vernon or the PACT Act at the VA in West Haven, we must make sure that no veteran has to fight for what they're due. Mayor Daniel Champagne noted that the federal grant will ensure Phelps Village residents will have a safe and comfortable place to live with services. Vernon is proud to be the home of Phelps Village and its important work assisting veterans who have experienced homelessness. Town Administrator Michael Picaro said that the Chrysalis Center has transformed an historic downtown home into a vibrant community that honors the service of our veterans. We are grateful to Senator Blumenthal for securing these funds and to the many volunteers and community groups that have and continue to support the Chrysalis Center's vital work. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on March 4th. It's written by Ken Dixon, and it's titled, Proposed bill would require guests at private campgrounds to sign liability waivers. Connecticut's private campground industry on Monday asked the state lawmakers to make it easier for them to run their companies by making visitors accept a degree of risk for spending days and nights out in nature where hazards such as bee stings can occur. Under the legislation that came before the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee in a public hearing, the 48-member Connecticut Campground Owners Association said it worked with the Connecticut Trial Lawyers Association on a bill that would require campground guests to sign contracts accepting some degrees of risk. The proposal would not exempt campground owners from incidents and injuries arising out of negligence. Brian Corton, owner of the Water's Edge Family Campground in Lebanon, and chairman of the association, said that potential dangers are typical in camping and that the bill would put campgrounds on the same legal footing as ski areas and riding stables. It recognizes that there are inherent risks in the camping experience, in addition to acknowledging the need for providing as safe an environment as possible. This legislation attempts to acknowledge the responsibilities of both the camper and the campground in providing a safe and enjoyable camping experience. We feel this legislation helps to provide fair and equitable treatment of both campers and campgrounds in the event of an injury. State Representative Craig Fishbein of Wallingford, a top Republican on the committee, reviewed some scenarios that might differentiate negligence and the general risk of camping. Campers, maybe some workers, have been stung by bees. And then somebody comes there and camps and their kids get stung by a bee and dies because they're allergic. Would there be an exemption from a suit in that particular case? We feel that each case should be determined on a case-by-case basis, Corton replied. There are so many different scenarios that could come up. A claim like that probably would be put through an insurance company, Fishbein said. That would be an inherent risk of camping because it's nature, right? Corton agreed. Similarly, another fact pattern, there's a group at the campground that traditionally gets drunk, rowdy, causes disturbances, and it's gone on a few times, and now it happens again, and there's a fight, and somebody gets injured. Am I to expect that is not inherent to camping? Correct, Corton said. That would not be on the campground management for not handling that. He said that the economic impact of states' private campgrounds is about $210 million per year. The industry supports 1,000 jobs and more than $36 million in wages. We clearly want to provide an environment where this element of our economy can grow and prosper while providing a wonderful outdoor experience for our visitors. This bill just tries to help those campground owners by establishing common sense responsibility for an individual engaged in this outdoor activity, said veteran State Representative John Piscopo, Republican from Thomaston, in written testimony. The legislation would require campgrounds defined as having five or more campsites to post warning signs stating that each camper shall assume the risk for any injury arising out of formal camping hazards. When Piscopo spoke to the committee early Monday afternoon, he said the current bill took years to develop. Over the years, and especially this session, great pains have been taken to craft the language to get a balance between the campground owners and those campers. There was no testimony filed in opposition to the legislation. The committee's deadline for action is April 1st. The legislature's short 13-week session ends on midnight, May 8th. In an unrelated part of the hearing, the Connecticut Trial Lawyers Association spoke in favor of a bill aimed at amending state law on the potential targets of civil suits in cases of dog bites. The proposed clarification would resolve a split among superior courts on whether both the owner and keeper may be found liable under the dog bite statute, said Kathleen Nastri, a past president of the association, stressing that a minor reworking could make it easier for courts to decide who should be held responsible for injuries resulting from dog fights or bites. The dog bite statute is strictly liability statute, Nastri said. It doesn't require anyone to prove fault on the part of the owner or the keeper of a dog. The stated purpose of the statute is to compensate victims of dog bites or dog injuries. She said there are conflicting decisions among judges on the issue because the current law includes the word or that makes it harder for litigants to decide who has the greater responsibility, the registered owner of a canine or the handler at the time of an incident. It makes things very complicated, Nastri noted, adding that in recent years she has a case that was prevented from being settled out of court. It's an important correction. I think it will resolve a lot of issues that we have pending out there for victims of dog bites. Our next article was posted to the Town of Sterling online service on March 5th. It's written by Jesse Leavenworth, and it's titled, Residents in Rural Eastern Connecticut Sue Farm Owners Over Damage. Rural residents who say roaming pigs and cattle from a local farm have gobbled their crops, dug up their lawns, and defecated all over the properties have sued the farm owners. The complaint against Ryan and Alicia Salvas and Radical Roots Farm contends negligence and recklessness in the farmers' failure to fence in swine and bovines that have allegedly caused tens of thousands of dollars in damage over the past 2 years. Filed in State Superior Court in Windham, the lawsuit seeks the standard damages of $15,000 or more, along with an injunction to force Radical Roots owners to contain their animals. Pigs in groups as large as 22 animals invaded Michael Grenier's two-acre property at least 20 times in September and October, cratering about 70% of his lawn, according to the lawsuit. Repairs will cost $23,000 to $28,000. Cows have hoofed onto neighboring farmer Paul Tetrault's property no less than 100 times, the lawsuit states, destroying the corn crop for 2 years running, consuming the vegetable garden, and contaminating with their defecation Tetrault's hay bales, grain, and silage meant for his own animals. Radical Roots owners could not be reached on Monday, and no defense lawyer is listed on the lawsuit. Other plaintiffs say the wayward cows and pigs have trampled their gardens, snapped their shrubs, eaten their hay and chicken feed, and caused them prolonged frustration. From April to September or last year, the regional authority, the Northeast Connecticut Council of Governments, reported Radical Roots pigs on 11 different properties between Newport Road and Pine Hill Road. On one day in April, the animal control officer spotted pigs on four properties at the same time. By October of 2023, the pigs had taken over Pine Hill Road, causing damage to almost all of the plaintiff's properties on a daily basis. The defendant's pigs have dug and rooted the plaintiff's and other neighbors' lawns, ate their gardens and flower beds, and in some cases aggressively pursued their owners. The lawsuit contends that defendants have refused or otherwise failed to recapture all of their pigs. As a result, several of the defendant's pigs have since been roaming the woods and neighboring properties of the plaintiffs for several months, to the point where the State Department of Agriculture has now classified them as being borderline feral animals. Furthermore, those animals have now given birth to several piglets who also roam the woods and homes of the plaintiffs uncontrolled. The State Agricultural Department continues to monitor the situation, agency spokesperson Rebecca Eddy said on Monday. Last fall, the U.S. Department of Agriculture installed cameras in local woods to track the loose swine. On Monday, agency USDA spokesperson Tanya Espinosa said, "We do not have cameras up currently as no animals were seen." Sterling First Selectman Link Cooper said town officials have not heard complaints for about the last 3 months, but I suspect it's going to open back up in the spring when the grass gets green. The first selectman, who has said that Ryan Salvas has not taken a responsible approach and it has led to some real misery for neighbors, said Monday he does not know where the roaming pigs are now. He has had no contact with Radical Roots, and a check of various slaughterhouses found no large-scale deliveries of pigs. It's kind of a mystery at this point as to where they all are. Concerned that feral pigs would gain a foothold in Connecticut and cause the kind of widespread damage that have wreaked in other states, state legislators penned a letter in September to State Agricultural Commissioner Brian Hurlburt and the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Commissioner Katie Dykes. "We write today to ask that you invoke the authority of your respective departments to get involved in a situation in the town of Sterling, which is allowed, if allowed to progress, could potentially decimate large swaths of nature and agricultural land in eastern Connecticut." The lawsuit says residents in Canterbury had complained about loose livestock from farms the Salvases ran there several years before they bought the farm in Sterling in April 2021. The lawsuit notes that the animal control authorities have ticketed Ryan Salvas 64 times on charges of allowing roaming livestock from the Sterling farm from April 19th to November 7th, 2023. Those cases are pending in Superior Court in Danielson, according to online court files. A prosecutor at the court could not be reached Monday, but Cooper said citations are worthless without consequences. "If you can't get the court system to work, I don't see any change happening. I don't care how many task forces are formed," referring to a bill that legislators are considering. The proposal before the Environment Committee would establish a task force to study the enforcement of current state law on loose livestock in order to prevent the occurrence of certain undesired interactions between roaming swine and bovines. The panel would have to report its findings by the beginning of 2025. Our next article was posted to the City of Hartford online service on March 5th. It's written by Bill Cummings, and it's titled, "Connecticut Treasurer's Office Didn't Follow Rules on Unclaimed Property and Ethics." The Office of the State Treasurer under a previous administration failed to properly dispose of unused state property, follow ethics disclosure rules, and correctly handle unclaimed property, according to a new state audit. State auditors in their 15-page report called on the office to improve internal controls. The treasurer's office largely agreed in written responses, including within the report, and said changes have been made to address the problems. A spokesperson for State Treasurer Eric Russell declined further comment beyond agency responses included with the audit. The period audited fiscal years 2021 and 2022 was prior to Russell's tenure, which began in January 2023. Former Treasurer Sean Wooden, who was in the office during the audit period, did not respond to an email seeking comment. The Treasurer's office is responsible for administering the state's unclaimed property, the Second Injury Fund, and the Connecticut Higher Education Trust. The office also administers the state's pension funds, debt management, and cash management. The audit notes that the State Property Control Manual establishes the Department of Administrative Services Surplus Unit as the legally authorized agent for disposal of surplus state property and directs agencies to list those assets on the state's auction website or receive pre-authorization to dispose of it. The auditors reviewed 20 assets totaling $164,000, which were removed from the treasurer's inventory during the years examined, and found in that three of those instances, the treasurer's office lacked disposal authorization records. Four instances in which the office did not have complete disposal authorization records, and 13 instances where the office did not remove assets from its inventory records until one of the 3 years after disposal. If the office does not maintain or regularly update property control records, there is increased risk that property could go missing or be improperly disposed, according to the auditors. The finding has been previously reported in the last audit report covering the fiscal years 2019 through 2020. The Office of the Treasurer should improve internal controls over the assets disposal process and accuracy of its property control records to ensure compliance with the State Property Control Manual, according to the auditor's recommendations. In response, the Treasurer's Office agreed with the finding and provided explanations. The Treasurer agrees that certain inventory records were not updated in a timely manner with the required documentation for certain items during a large surplus of property necessitated by the office's move to a new building during the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2020. Since that time, internal controls over assets disposal have been improved, including staff training, purchase of an iPad for image uploading, and a detailed written surplus procedure, which is now in effect. This ensures that all supporting documentation is updated to the state surplus and core CT asset management portfolios within 10 days after they are removed. In another finding, auditors pointed out the State Office of Policy and Management requires all employees participating in a request for proposal RFP process to sign an ethics and confidentiality agreement at the start and recertify after the agency receives responses from interested vendors. Auditors requested ethics and confidentiality agreements for RFPs between February 21 and September 2022 and noted that the office lacked four certification forms. Participants signed 19 of the forms 1 to 4 months after the office started the process, and the office did not ensure that the RFP participants recertified 7 forms. The office also recertified 15 ethics forms up to 5 months after the RFP process ended, according to the state auditors. The office did not comply with the Office of Policy and Management's procurement standards, auditors wrote. RFP participants that do not review and attest to the ethics and a confidentiality agreement during the procurement process may not be as vigilant about the risk of conflicts of interest. In response, the agency agreed it should strengthen internal controls to ensure compliance with completion of an ethics and confidentiality form. The Treasurer's Office has implemented a version of the OPM procurement standards as part of a comprehensive system of internal controls that includes additional safeguards and has implemented changes to ensure more consistent and timely compliance with the ethics certification standards, the office said in their response. Auditors also pointed out the unclaimed property division of the Treasurer's Office must follow established guidelines for approving claims prior to payment. The guidelines require final approval from the Assistant Treasurer or Office Controller for claims over $250,000. Unclaimed property is any asset legally obtained and held by the state until the rightful owners are located. Unclaimed assets include savings or checking accounts, uncashed checks, matured certificates of deposit, stocks, bonds or mutual funds, traveler's checks, or money orders and proceeds from life insurance policies. If the rightful owner is located, the asset is returned or paid to that person or entity. The audit found the office reviewed 55 paid unclaimed property claims totaling $26,000 during fiscal year 2021 and 2022, and identified 5 claims over $250,000 missing final approval from the assistant treasurer or division comptroller. The claims totaled $2.3 million. Auditors also noted one instance, despite proper approval, in which the division lacked supporting documentation for a $254,000 claim. Improper approval of claims increases the risk of undetected errors in processing unclaimed property returns, according to the state auditors. The unclaimed property division should then strengthen internal controls to ensure it follows established claim approval guidelines. The agency agreed it should strengthen those controls, but the office said it should be noted that the claims cited in this finding were all valid claims paid in the appropriate amounts and processed in accordance with established procedures. The treasurer's office also added that the claims identified in this audit finding were processed during a period of management transition with the retirement of a longtime assistant treasurer in the midst of COVID and extensive staff absences in the period of time before the hiring of a new assistant treasurer. In addition, during this time, there were major system changes underway, the addition of a paralegal staff support for the claims review and approval process that was intended to have higher level approval authority was not updated in the written policies. Since then, the agency said it has initiated an overhaul of the approval guidelines and has tightened the automatic system controls. With the addition of new positions and job descriptions within unclaimed property, a reassessment of the assignment of appropriate levels of review is also underway. Our next article was posted to the Town of Norwalk online service on March 5th. It's written by Paul Schott, and it's titled, Bob's Stores Set to Close in Current Location in Norwalk. Bob's Stores will close this week its Norwalk location, but the apparel and footwear retailer is planning to open another store in the city within the next few months. Company officials have confirmed that Sunday will be the last day of business for Bob's Stores in the shopping center at 380 Main Street off exit 40 of the Mayor Parkway, where it has operated since 1996. Bob's has held a closing sale there since last summer. In the spring, Bob plans to open a new store at 542 Westport Avenue in Norwalk that will carry Bob's and Eastern Mountain Sports merchandise. Bob's and EMS are owned by the same parent company. The new Bob's EMS store will operate in a storefront that previously housed a Bed Bath & Beyond store, which closed last spring. All employees of the current Norwalk store will transfer to the new location, according to Bob's officials. Among other locations, Bob closed on January 28th its store at 889 Post Road in the Fairfield Shopping Center. Bob's officials have said, however, they are planning to open a new store in Fairfield. We are currently in the process of identifying the ideal location, Kevin Campbell, Executive Vice President of Operations for Bob's Stores and EMS, said recently in a written statement. At 889 Post Road, Restoration Hardware has signed a 35,000-square-foot lease for an outlet store to fill the space formerly occupied by Bob's. Fairfield-based True Commercial Real Estate, which was one of the brokers of the Restoration Hardware's lease, is now listing the 47,000-square-foot space in the shopping center in Norwalk that houses Bob's. That storefront stands between Stop and Shop and Total Wine and More. A message left for True Connecticut asking about potential new tenants for the closing Bob's storefront in Norwalk was not returned. In addition to the changes in Fairfield and Norwalk, Bob's last year expanded its network in Connecticut. In October, it opened a store at 835 Queen Street in Southington, and in August, it returned to Hamden with a reopening at the Hamden Mart Shopping Center, the same site where it had closed the store in December 2020. Within Connecticut, there are also Bob's locations in Ansonia, Manchester, Middletown, Milford, Newington, Simsbury, Waterbury, and Waterford. There are two EMS locations in Connecticut, a new store which opened on February 28th at the Danbury Square Shopping Plaza in Danbury, and a store within the Bob's establishment at the Crossroads Shopping Center in Waterford. Bob's is a homegrown business for Connecticut. It was started in 1954 by founder Bob Lapidus with a single store in Middletown and eventually expanded to 27 stores throughout the Northeast, according to its website. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on March 4th. It's written by Pamela Brown, and it's titled, Connecticut group helps people around the world to see better. You might miss the boxes around town at the post office in front of city halls. One can also be seen at the New Britain Berlin YMCA adorned with a Lions Club logo. The boxes are part of Lions Clubs International's nationwide eyeglass recycling program that collects eyeglasses and sunglasses for both adults and children and distributes them to less developed countries through optical missions and local Lions Clubs. Lions Clubs International has been working to combat vision impairment and blindness since 1925, according to the organization. To do that, local clubs place collection boxes at locations in their communities in which people can place old or unused eyeglasses and sunglasses. This is a program that continues to grow because the need continues to grow, said Doug Bray, a 39-year New Britain Lions Club member and club secretary. The Lions Club has clubs in 204 countries and sends glasses to those countries considered to be developing. They work with nations in the Middle East, Africa, South America, and Central America. It feels good to be part of this. A lot of the charitable work we do helps other people. The Lions Club motto is, we serve. What makes the Lions Club unique is each club does what is most important in their community. The boxes are part of the Lions Club's international nationwide eyeglass recycling program that collects eyeglasses and sunglasses for both adults and children and distributes them to less developed countries through optical missions and local Lions Clubs. Lions Club International was established as a service-centered organization in 1917 by Melvin Jones, a Chicago businessman, with the goal of helping communities through humanitarian services and encouraging peace and international understanding through the Lions Clubs. Most of the boxes have been handmade by a member and clearly identified with the recognizable Lions Club logo of two lions heads and marked with deposit use eyeglasses here. One exception is the box at the New Britain City Hall. It is a refurbished post office collection box. Each box holds up to 400 pairs of glasses. Each year, the New Britain's Lions Club collects about 100,000 pairs, and from that, over 60,000 have to be thrown out because they're broken or unusable, according to the club. Usually about 40,000 are deemed usable. New Britain is also the collection site for Hartford and Litchfield counties. This is a massive sorting process that goes on before the glasses reach their final destination overseas. The Lions Club has partnered with Syracuse Moving and Storage in New Britain, a professional moving company that provides a collection space. A member of our club has approached Dan Syracuse, the president, and in his company, Spiritedness, offered this very large space where all the glasses are stored. We're very thankful to them. They have such generosity and the community spirit at heart. In March, the glasses are transported by truck to Syracuse's facility where volunteers come together to sort the thousands upon thousands of glasses. For 3 weeks, the Lions, spouses, local teachers, and students from New Britain schools, members of the Boys and Girls Clubs, and community members cull through the eyeglasses and discard the broken ones. For the people who do not understand this, the glass packing and screening, there's a lot of reward for their effort. From there, the glasses are sealed in a box and sent to their next location for further evaluation and processing at a state prison in Avalon, New Jersey, that serves Lions Clubs across the Northeast. The inmates are specially trained to use equipment to inspect, clean, and identify the prescription strengths of each eyeglass. The eyeglass recycling program began in 1925 as a result of a request from Helen Keller, an advocate for people with disabilities who spoke at a Lions Club International convention, and asked them to foster the work of the American Foundation for the Blind and challenge them to become Knights of the Blind in this crusade against darkness. Keller lived for a time in Connecticut, according to the Connecticut Historical Society. The Lions accepted her challenge and have worked to help people with visual impairments and create sight programs aimed at preventable blindness. For anyone who has old eyeglasses or sunglasses they are ready to throw out, the Lions suggest looking for the boxes and tossing them in. When glasses are no longer good for you, they can help others. When word spreads in the villages that the Lions are coming to town, villagers line up, and it's a wonderful thing. Our next article was posted to the Town of Montville online service on March 4th. It's written by Alex Wood, and it's titled, Montville Fire Department Official Wrongfully Arrested. The public information officer for one of the town's fire departments is suing local police lieutenant he claims engineered his arrest on a charge of violating a state law that limits the photographs emergency personnel can take of people receiving emergency assistance, according to court documents. In the lawsuit filed on February 13th in U.S. District Court in Connecticut, Stephen Frischling of the Chesterfield Fire Company alleges that Lieutenant David Radford violated his civil rights by including false information in an affidavit that formed the basis for his March 2021 arrest and omitting evidence of innocence. Also named as defendants in the lawsuit are the town of Montville and State Police Sergeant Albert Gosselin, who at the time was Montville's resident state trooper. The suit filed by Frischling by lawyer Dennis Carnelli charges that Gosselin approved Radford's affidavit, although he knew or should have known it included false or misleading statements. An assistant to Montville Mayor Leonard Bunnell said he would have no comment on the lawsuit. Radford and the assistant state attorney general representing Gosselin could not be reached for comment. Frischling said on Friday that he is still the Chesterfield Fire Company's public information officer. Never left, don't plan to, I kind of like the job. At issue in the case are pictures Frischling took at the scene of a motor vehicle accident on Route 85 and Grassy Hill Road in Montville on February 7, 2021. He then posted the photographs on the Chesterfield Fire Department public information officer's Facebook page, according to his lawsuit. Frischling was arrested the following month based on a 2011 state law that prohibits any emergency responder from photographing someone receiving medical or other assistance without the person's consent, other than in the performance of his or her duties. A judge dismissed the charge against Frischling more than 2 years after his arrest when he insisted on going to trial, the lawsuit said. He was free on a $1,000 bond while the misdemeanor case was pending. A key claim in Frischling's lawsuit is that he was performing his official duties as public information officer when he took the pictures, and therefore he feels he did not violate the law. He charges that Radford omitted from the arrest warrant affidavit any reference to the written duties and responsibilities of the Chesterfield Fire Department's public information officer, which his complaint says includes photographing incident scenes for release to the public. The pictures of the scene included occupants of the vehicles, and in one particular picture, the victim was still in the vehicle being extricated, Radford wrote in his affidavit. A second photo also depicted a male standing next to an individual being strapped to a stretcher for transport. Frischling's lawsuit denies those claims and charges that Radford knew they were false when he made them. The suit says the photos Frischling posted were digitally altered to obscure the license plate of the vehicle in the accident and the head of a first responder. Frischling explained on Friday that he blurred the person's head because he was uncertain about their identity. He said he later learned the person was the assistant chief of another fire company who was rendering aid to the victim in the crash. The lawsuit charges that Radford and a prosecutor tried to negotiate changes in the duties of public information officers for Montville's fire departments regarding photography and social media in exchange for dropping the charges against Frischling. My goal here is that this never happens again to any public information officer or departmental photographer, Frischling said. This is not the intent of the law. Our next article was published in the Record Journal on March 4th. It's written by Chris Villalonga, and it's titled, Connecticut Tries to Add Workers as Children Wait Weeks for Mental Health Services. Connecticut children are often waiting weeks before they can get their recommended mental health services, largely due to a growing need after the pandemic in an area facing worker shortages, according to a new study by the Child Health and Development Institute. Prior to the pandemic, Connecticut's array of behavioral health intermediate levels of care for children was envied by other states. They reduced the need for out-of-home care, the number of residential placements, and hospital gridlock, said Elizabeth Cannata, Vice President of Community-Based Services and practice innovation at Wheeler Clinic. Then comes COVID. The aftermath of COVID is that children are in more behavioral health distress than ever before. Although the definition varies, ILCs are typically services in the middle of the behavioral health care continuum to serve youths who don't require inpatient hospitalization but need more support than outpatient treatment. It can include both home services and center-based programming, and were designed to keep children in their community and have the appropriate level of care. Kanata said that ILC system has developed a lot in the past 25 years after a series of studies found children in crisis were struck in higher levels of care because of the lack of community-based services. According to the study, 66 ILC center-based programs currently serve Connecticut youth. Of them, 25 are intensive outpatient, 13 are partial hospitalization programs, 23 are extended day treatment, and 5 are psychiatric residential treatment facilities. In general, the report found that ILC programs were in higher demand than they had the capacity to care for. The main challenge was staffing, resulting in less available care, longer wait lists, and delays in discharge from inpatient care settings. Kelly said the demand outpacing capacity is exemplified by the barriers mobile crisis units face when referring young clients to the ILC services. A survey found the main barriers were wait lists, transportation, scheduling conflicts, and eligibility due to age, and the limited geographic reach of services. Other issues in the ILC system included data collection, the sporadic use of evidence-based treatments across programs, and the limited use of measurement-based care. There's also limited access to services for youth with intellectual disabilities, developmental disabilities, or autism spectrum disorder. The report highlighted several system-wide and program-specific suggestions. Outside of addressing the workforce shortage, the report recommends increasing the capacity and availability of ILCs, improving data collection and diversifying program leadership, staff, and clientele. The report also offered several options to standardize procedures and practices, such as expanding training opportunities on evidence-based treatments and implementing measurement-based care. It also recommended continuing to review psychiatric residential treatment facility programs. Kanata said she agrees with the workforce development and recruiting more diverse clinical staff. However, she noted that the current funding structures don't provide the opportunity to offer competitive pay for the work and attract more people to the field. The Institute already shared the report with the Department of Children and Families, which commissioned the study, and hope to potentially partner to implement the recommendations, said Elise Kelly, Senior Associate for the Child Health and Development Institute, and one of the study's co-authors. Kelly cautioned the workforce shortage needs to be addressed early on, though. Those programs, on average, are short about a third of their staff. It's challenging to make all these changes in implementation if you don't have the staff to do it. Strengthening and standardizing the different programs that often serve overlapping populations especially stood out among the recommendations for a study co-author Jason Lang, who is also the chief program officer at the Child Health and Development Institute. He said he would also like to see which populations are and aren't served by the programs and if there's not enough capacity in the certain areas. But again, all that really will depend on being able to have the workforce to support it. Lang noted that there are already ongoing discussions on addressing the workforce shortage and bolstering programs such as increasing the Medicaid reimbursement rates, which are the very low for behavioral health. We all feel like that's the first step, and it may be possible to tie some of the other recommendations. We'll pay providers more, but they need to do a better job of collecting data or using a standardized program model and some of the other things that we recommend. But I think that remains to be seen what the legislature will do. The new study found significant medical staffing challenges across the ILC continuum, creating gaps in access. On average, extended day treatment or EDT programs reported being short 36% of their staff, intensive outpatient programs short 23%, and partial hospitalization programs down 37%. However, almost no changes to programming were reported, even with staffing challenges. As a result, ILC programs report a 2 to 6 week wait for children to start services. EDT showed a median of 26 days between referral and start date for children who received services in fiscal year 2023, with longer waits for Black and Hispanic children. The workforce shortage is particularly felt in the EDT program, said Hector Glenn, Chief Executive Officer at the Village for Families and Children in Hartford. EDTs are after-school programs that often need more staff to provide care, drive the children to and from the program, and work odd hours. Flynn said a notable takeaway in the report is the number of people EDT services helped has not bounced back after the COVID-19 emergency. In-person individual therapy successfully transitioned to teletherapy when the pandemic started. But group therapy sessions like EDT's were not therapeutic when it was online. As telehealth became the norm, the use of EDT's entered a downward trajectory and sort of flattened out. Other social barriers, such as the lack of transportation, may deter families from using a long-term, everyday program. Outside of addressing the workforce shortages through increased funding, Glenn said he would love to discuss the report's recommendations on expanding evidence-based treatments, especially regarding EDT. Since EDT groups are designed so children can enroll at any time for extended periods, it is challenging to implement these models in this type of care setting. However, he noted how other ILC programs, such as intensive outpatient, have successfully implemented evidence-based treatments. In addition, he said that the low Medicaid reimbursement rates for behavioral health services make it harder to pay competitive wages for staff. The staffing shortage has an extra challenge with the program's team approach. If we lose one member of the team, it becomes very difficult, and if we lose the clinician, we cannot run a unit. So we still have staffing costs, but we can't enroll clients even if we have a wait list because we don't have the right ratios of staff. ILC programs also reported needing help sending staff to training opportunities, and there wasn't much diversity among staff and leadership, race, ethnicity, and languages, according to the report. The report did note several strengths within the Connecticut ILC system, such as programs aligning with state-level care guidelines, an extended day program successfully servicing a diverse population. Also, ILC staff reported having supportive work environments, were interested in attending more training opportunities, and were open to collaborating with families. Kanata said she wasn't surprised by the findings of the report, but thought it was helpful to see the different opportunities to strengthen the use of evidence-based treatments in center-based ILC. She said research shows these programs helped different demographics of children. That's an important piece of why we need to look at research-supported interventions, but then also make sure that the interventions we're choosing are effective with all of the populations we want to serve. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on March 4th. It's written by Jordan Fenster, and it's titled, "Could Connecticut Native American Tribes Grow Cannabis?" Unable to build casinos, several of Connecticut's Native American tribes could instead turn to cannabis. Connecticut recognizes five Native American tribes and bylaws manage tribal funds, but without federal recognition, three of those tribes have been unable to build a casino or use their land to create jobs for tribal members. State Senator Kathy Austin, Democrat from Sprague, said the state has essentially taken responsibility for the state tribes without federal recognition and prevented them from taking care of themselves. Everybody thought that everybody was going to do a casino, but a casino is not the only way to make money. We really need to have something that allows some revenue generation to happen for the state-recognized tribes. When the state law creating Connecticut's recreational cannabis market was passed, it included a provision to allow the Mashantucket, Pequot, and Mohegan tribes, both recognized by state and federal authorities, to grow cannabis if they so chose. Excluded were the Shakotoki, Pawcatuck, Eastern Pequot, and the Golden Hill Pawcosset tribes, all of which are recognized by the state but not the federal government. I think that they thought the state-recognized tribes weren't yet there and the bill itself was very hard to pass, according to Austin. Now the state legislature is considering a bill to consider lands owned by those three tribes disproportionately impacted areas called DIAs, which would allow them to cultivate cannabis. A separate proposal would allow tribal members to grow cannabis on land that they do not own. Connecticut cannabis market has suffered from a shortage of cannabis in recent months, said Austin, and the proposal would both alleviate that pressure and simultaneously allow the tribes a revenue source. That's exactly how I see it. Austin also said that in part it should be about historical use of their lands. These are northeastern woodland tribes. They did a lot of work with the land. The Shakotokis, in particular, have attempted for decades to obtain federal recognition. In 2005, the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs informed the tribe by fax that a short-lived recognition would be revoked. It was Columbus Day. More recently, in 2019, there were concerns that a faction of the Shagatoki tribe would build a casino in Kent if it was federally recognized. Shagatoki Chief Richard Valkyrie said the goal is for all Native American tribes in Connecticut to be self-sufficient. It would be very exciting for the tribe. It would be a source of jobs for us. When the state approved the two tribes, the state should have approved all five state-recognized tribes at that time because it has nothing to do with federal recognition. They should have given us all of an opportunity to be able to do that. The Shagatoki tribe lays claim to 400 acres near Kent, but Vilke said there was no intention to build a cannabis facility there. We like being good neighbors. Vilke said there are five municipalities with whom the tribe is currently in discussion about a possible facility, but he declined to go into detail. The Golden Hill Pawgasset tribe owns what is thought to be the smallest Native American reservation in the United States, 25 acres in Trumbull. But Austin said that property could not be used for a cannabis facility, even a small one. That area would not be allowed because it is a residential area. Our next article was posted to the ctmira.org online service on March 4th. It's written by Andrew Brown, and it's titled, Many Connecticut Towns and Cities Have Not Spent Opioid Settlement Funds. Connecticut towns and cities recently received a combined $9.8 million from several nationwide legal settlements with opioid manufacturers, shippers, and retailers, but many of those municipalities are still deciding how to spend that money to combat the ongoing opioid epidemic. The State Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services sent a survey to Connecticut's 169 towns and cities last year to gauge how the municipalities are putting that cash to use and to ensure the proceeds from the settlement are being spent on their intended purpose. The responses to that survey showed a number of municipalities are spending the settlement funds on things such as prescription drug take-back events, harm reduction supplies, drug prevention programs for school-aged children, and by purchasing and distributing Naloxone, the overdose-reversing drug. The biggest takeaway from the survey, however, was that most towns and cities had yet to spend any of the settlement money as of last fall. Of the $9.8 million the towns and cities received, only $1 million of that money was allocated to help combat the state's deadly opioid epidemic, which claimed the lives of an estimated 1,200 Connecticut residents last year. At least 98 of the state's towns and cities reported that they hadn't spent any of the funds as of last October. One of the main reasons that many small towns did not expend the money was because they netted only several thousand dollars through the nationwide legal settlements to this point. Local officials from those towns explained to the State Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services that the minimal amount of money they received made it difficult to address opioid addiction in their municipalities. It also a symptom of Connecticut's lack of county governments and the network of municipalities that dominate the state. The town of Bridgewater, one of the smallest towns in Connecticut with roughly 1,700 residents, told the state it placed its $1,100 in opioid settlement money into the town's general fund in order to pay for energy assistance for low-income households. Curtis Reed, Bridgewater's first selectman, told the Connecticut Mirror that he did not know how to spend the settlement proceeds in a way that could make a meaningful difference in opioid addiction. Reed recognized that Bridgewater was not immune to the nationwide opioid epidemic, but in a small town where there isn't a professional staff to manage government operations, he said the settlement funds took a back seat to other priorities such as recent flooding. We haven't even talked about it on a selectman level, Reed said. You can't really never cover the whole gamut of responsibility. Bridgewater is not alone in that regard. Other small towns expressed the same problems in the survey responses, emphasizing that they either didn't have the staff to create a new opioid-related program or didn't receive enough money to do anything with it. Officials in Scotland, a town of roughly 1,500 in eastern Connecticut, told the State Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services that it didn't have the necessary staff to administer the settlement funds. In the scheme of things, the town gets an amount too small for long-term spending, officials in the nearby Volantown explained. To overcome the limited amount of money that small towns receive, some municipalities in Connecticut created partnerships with their local health districts or pool their settlement funds with other municipalities in their region. One example of that type of collaboration can be seen in Connecticut's Northwest Corner, where 11 rural towns agreed to provide all or a portion of their settlement money to the Northwest Hills Council of Government. Leonardo Gio, who was leading that collaboration for the Northwest Hills COG, said the 11 participating towns were able to collectively pool around $40,000 into what has been coined the Regional Opioid Response Fund, and the COG has not wasted any time in getting portions of that money out into the communities. The pooled settlement funds, Gio said, were used to purchase supplies for leave-behind kits that are provided to anyone who overdoses and is transported by ambulance to a hospital. The kits are meant to supply those individuals with the saving medication such as Naloxone and information on recovery programs. We know that about 90% of overdoses in our region are happening in people's homes, so emergency responders are a key stakeholder in that effort. The money was also allocated to the Litchfield County Opioid Task Force, which is a coalition of substance abuse and behavioral health providers in the region. That money is meant to help the organizations purchase harm reduction supplies like clean syringes and drug testing kits. You know, this is what they do, Gio said, so instead of reinventing the wheel, we figured that we would support their efforts. Some of the large and mid-sized cities in Connecticut also are partnering with other organizations when spending their settlement funds. Meriden announced last year that it planned to spend a portion of its more than $209,000 to help Rushford, a local addiction and mental health care provider, to start up a new mobile unit to perform outreach to people dealing with opioid use disorders. The city contributed $20,000 to help retrofit a decommissioned ambulance that was donated by Hunter's Ambulance Service and to stock the vehicle with harm reduction supplies that Rushford will pass out to drug users in the city. Leah Crown, Meriden's Director of Health and Human Services, said the new mobile unit will be deployed in areas of the city where data shows overdoses are occurring. The plan for retrofitting the ambulance was able to happen quickly, Crown said, because the city and Rushford were already working together on a program known as the Meriden Opioid Referral for Recovery, which is meant to help first responders in Meriden to connect people with treatment at the Rushford Center. Some municipalities in Connecticut are taking a little longer, however, to explore their options for the settlement funding and to make sure that they can create sustainable programs that will have a lasting effect in their community. Officials in Torrington, for instance, told the state last fall that it was looking to develop a public process for deciding how to spend the more than $131,000 it received from the settlements. We have opted to use the city council in a public hearing process to determine how to spend the funds, Eleanor Carbone, Torrington's mayor, said. She said one of the things the city is likely to consider is a request from the Torrington Police Department to use some of the funds to hire a social worker to work with police, which she said could satisfy the requirements of the National Settlement Agreement. New Haven is another city that is still trying to establish the rules for how it will spend its settlement funds. Maritza Bond, the city's director of public health, said her health department is already receiving $2 million per year over the next 5 years from another federal grant to help combat the opioid epidemic across New Haven County. As a result, she said her department did not feel rushed to begin spending the settlement funding as soon as it arrived in the city's bank account. Bond said she wanted to make sure the city had a long-term plan for how to spend its share of those funds and to ensure any programs it finances are sustainable. We wanted to make sure we were going to be strategic about the process. None of this New Haven's more than $599,000 in settlement funds has been spent to this point. But Bond said her department is nearing the end of a procurement process that will allow local nonprofit service providers to apply for portions of the money. Organizations that provide opioid treatments, harm reduction supplies, and supportive measures to people who are in recovery will be eligible to apply for those grants, which allow them to hire more staff, build necessary infrastructure, and to expand access for their services. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on March 6th. It's written by Allison Cross, and it's titled, Connecticut Lawmakers Want Infertility Treatment Coverage for All. In the face of Alabama's ruling on in vitro fertilization, or IVT, and continued legislative attacks on the LGBTQ plus community, Connecticut lawmakers are considering legislation that would expand health insurance coverage for infertility treatments to same-sex couples and individuals who wish to have a child on their own. At a public hearing on Tuesday, supporters of House Bill 5378 said the proposal would provide equal access to coverage for all individual and group policy holders seeking infertility treatment, regardless of their gender, sexual orientation, or relationship status. Opponents expressed concern that the bill would require heterosexual couples to jump through more hoops to receive coverage for infertility treatments than individuals or couples who identify as LGBTQ+. House Bill 5378, which was introduced by the Insurance and Real Estate Committee last week, would broaden the state's definition of infertility to include the inability as an individual or with a partner to conceive or produce conception because the individual or couple does not have the necessary gametes to conceive or produce conception. Gametes are egg cells and sperm, the reproductive cells required for conception. Currently, the state defines infertility as the condition of an individual who is unable to conceive or produce conception or sustain a successful pregnancy during a one-year period. HB 5378's definition would remove the requirement that individuals, LGBTQ+ couples, or heterosexual couples who lack gametes wait 1 year to prove their liability to conceive a child before they can access infertility coverage. As written, HB 5378 would only apply to individual and group health insurance policies, but a separate bill in the Human Services Committee would expand infertility coverage to patients on Medicaid. Everybody in this state who wants to have a child should be able to do so, regardless of who they love and who they want to have that child with, according to Connecticut State Comptroller Sean Scanlon. Scanlon said he amended the state employee health insurance policy last year to include infertility coverage for LGBTQ+ couples and individuals after an employee alerted him that the former health plan discriminated against her and her wife, who, like so many other young couples, recently got married and decided they wanted to have a child. The problem that we were experiencing was that people who were on our plan were having to be deemed by a doctor to be infertile, and there was a period of time through which they had to have sexual intercourse that was not resulting in a pregnancy. No matter how much her and her partner had sex, they were never going to have a baby in the way that a man and woman could. Scanlon said that under the state employee plan and House Bill 5378, same-sex couples would not need to be deemed infertile by a physician in order to access the insurance. Given that, no amount of fertility in a same-sex couple would ever result in a baby. Scanlon said that for those who lack insurance coverage, the cost of infertility treatment is quite prohibitive to people in our state right now who would love nothing more than to have that child and experience that gift. Under current state laws, private insurers are required to provide coverage for the medically necessary expenses for the diagnosis and treatment of infertility, including but not limited to ovulation induction, intrauterine insemination, in vitro fertilization, uterine embryo lavage, embryo transfer, gamete intrafallopian transfer, zygote intrafallopian transfer, and low tubal ovum transfer. Dr. Mark Leandiris, a board-certified obstetrician, gynecologist, and reproductive endocrinologist, who is the founder and medical director of Illume Fertility and Gay Parents-to-Be, said that the majority of LGBTQ+ patients at his fertility clinic lack coverage. Leandiris said that a pregnancy via intrauterine insemination could cost a couple $5,000 to $20,000 out of their pocket. For individuals or couples who require an egg donor and surrogate, Leandiris said the cost could reach $150,000. Leandiris said it's not uncommon for patients to stop reproductive health care due to the cost barriers. With every new mandate, it's just an increased cost to the policyholders, Wayne Bosworth, Associate Counsel of the CBIA, said. He encouraged the committee to have the proposal first undergo a health benefit review process, not just to make recommendations on whether the mandate is good or bad, but also help broaden the mandate to cover more people and then take into consideration the costs and benefits that come along with that. That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. If you have any questions about the articles read today or other programs at CHRIS, please call the CHRIS listener line at 860-727-9579.